Welcome to Making Coffee, a behind-the-scenes look at what goes into making one of the world's favorite beverages. I'm your host, Lucia Solis, a former winemaker turned coffee processing specialist. Thanks for joining this week's episode. Hello, friends, and welcome to episode 54. It's been a while since I sat down to record, and those of you who received the newsletter or check Instagram will know it's because Nick and I did a fermentation training camp in Indonesia in June, and then we spent a few more weeks visiting Vietnam and Japan after the camp. And from that trip, from that time, there's a lot of conversations and a lot of episodes coming from the people that I was able to meet and record with, so I'm really excited about that coming up pretty soon. But today's conversation with Tom from Sweet Maria's was recorded actually before we left for the trip, but we didn't get around to editing it until this week. So Tom and I have never met, but he is a patron of the podcast, and he reached out a while ago wanting to record an episode together. And I was really excited to receive his message because I listen to his podcast and I enjoy his thoughtful reflections. In this conversation, we talk about coffee tourism and travel. These are topics that are a spin-off of his podcast episodes 38 and 39. You don't have to listen to those episodes to enjoy this conversation, but I think they're very good episodes, and I will link them in the show notes so you can check them out later. Since its beginning, Sweet Maria's has been an incredible resource for curious coffee nerds who wanted to learn about home roasting basics, green coffee quality, roast profiles, and cupping. The Sweet Maria's website has an extensive coffee library and resource page, so I highly recommend you check it out if these topics interest you. You know, it's interesting because if you wanted to buy green coffee as a roaster, usually the smallest size you can buy is like, you know, one bag, about 150 pounds of green coffee. And even when you have like micro lots, they can be as big as 5 to 10 bags, so roughly 750 pounds to 1,500 pounds of coffee. For a roaster, this is a small batch, but for a home roaster, this is an unreasonable amount of coffee. Sweet Maria's sells as little as a single pound of carefully sourced and selected coffee. I think it's a great service because it's made specialty coffee more accessible to coffee lovers. Sweet Maria's began in 1997, so there are few people in the coffee industry who don't know about this home roasting gem or who don't know who Tom is. However, if this is your first time hearing about Tom, you're in for a treat because you're about to hear from someone who spends a lot of time thinking about his role and impact in the coffee space. Tom and I talked for a long time, so I don't want to make this intro too long, but I do want to remind you guys that I'm still planning fermentation training camps in Guatemala. Our next camp this December in Antigua is sold out, but if you email info.luciacoffee@gmail.com, you can be put on the waiting list and be the first to know when I open spots for the next one, which is potentially happening at the end of February 2024. You can also find more details on the fermentation camps on my website at Lucia Coffee. Lastly, I want to remind you guys that we are regularly getting together for office hours on Discord. We have also started a Spanish office hours to be inclusive of Spanish-speaking audience. I often hear from listeners of the podcast who have strong English skills but feel more limited in their speaking ability. So we created a Spanish channel and a Spanish office hours so we can all communicate more freely. Okay, enough housekeeping. Let's get started with Tom.
I guess something I didn't realize is that your wife and your partner as well, so you're both working in the business?
Well, she's actually not. Okay. So Maria was. She retired, basically. Yeah, so she's not really involved. She was more in the kind of the business part. And it's mainly me and Dan that do the green coffee part. And then, you know, it's about 22, 25 employees at the warehouse. So it's kind of medium sized, but, you know, it's sort of still family.
No, that's awesome. I was seeing, so my husband, Nick, does work with me. And so he doesn't usually travel with me, but this was, he's like, I'm not going to miss this. So
yeah,
he decided he wanted to, like, okay, how do we make it work? And if you're coming, let's just like, so it turned into this whole thing. So that's exciting. Yeah. And then again, very present on our minds, thinking about travel and just like, I think you and I have been having this travel conversation, like in asynchronous time over like months.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you started me thinking, I think I've I just keep doing things about travel and kind of photography too, because that's actually what I did my master's in, even though I didn't even use a camera when I did that. But I'm really familiar with all these ideas of representation that I brought over into coffee. And, you know, I think we had some back and forth, and that's spurred me to do that two-part tourism podcast, which I know that just came out of nowhere. The whole tourism thing, you know, it seems really unnatural, but I was looking for something that, you know, explains and provides a framework for cultural connection, because sometimes I think coffee travel literally is like a tourist expedition or, you know, trek. And there's like group trips where you get in a van and it really feels like that's what it is. And that's why I travel alone. But, you know, of course, a lot of times it's not, but I still think it's like a valuable framework for thinking about it.
Have you heard any feedback about those episodes?
Yeah, I mean, I got some thumbs ups. I don't feel like I get much sometimes, but a few things are coming in. And I was really interested, this friend on WhatsApp, that he's in Kansas City, and he sent me a thing saying he was fixing a motorcycle tire listening to it, and he just like couldn't understand what it was about. Like, he couldn't relate to it. And I really like this comment, because he just does what he does in coffee. You probably don't hear a lot about his company, because he's just like doing his thing. And I really appreciated, like, okay, I was like, you know, that's so great, this, you don't relate to this, because it's not the things that are something you think about when you travel, and that's great. So, you know, because I'm kind of forcing this tourism critique onto the coffee thing, it doesn't fit, you know, easily and naturally. I'm kind of making it fit so that I can understand, like, how, you know, what kind of criticism. There's departments of tourism studies, and there's people who have focused on it. It's kind of been a wormhole for me. And now I'm reading like two other books on the topic of tourism studies. And I still find it interesting. So,
well, I'm curious why you think it's forced and not a good fit. For me, it just lays so naturally on top of and provides a really good structure and a lot of evidence for what I've seen. So I think maybe it has to do with living in producing countries the way that I do versus somebody living in the United States and saying, okay, well, this isn't really relevant, or you feel like you're forcing it. But for me, who lives in these countries, I'm like, this, it just felt like such a breath of fresh air. I'm like, this is it. This is something that I see all of the time. And so I think maybe that's one of the privileges, is that when you travel, you only see it in these glimpses, and maybe you take a 2-week vacation per year, or you go. And so you're like, well, it's only 2 weeks out of my whole year. But for us who live in these countries, I'm like, this is all of my weeks. This is every single week of my year. And so it feels more relevant. So I think your comment about forcing it is really interesting to me. And I'm just like, wow, it doesn't feel forced at all.
That's really interesting that you found it. Are you saying that the dialogue around like tourism and coffee felt like something you observe from your position living in origin?
Well, yeah, in producing countries. Not necessarily something I observed, but don't observe enough of as having this conversation. So for you to be exploring these themes and to be exploring what it is to be, you know, an outsider coming into a new culture, and what are our responsibilities? How much safety and comfort do we want? How much adventure do we want? Like, all of these questions I feel are incredibly relevant, because I think one of the things that I really reacted to in those episodes that I really enjoyed, I'm so glad you made them, and I hope whoever listens to this has already listened to those or goes and immediately listens to those episodes, because we're going to reference them a lot, I hope. But something that I really was reacting to kind of in that sense, where you had this idea of like, I don't want to be the travel police. I don't want to tell people what to do. It feels really uncomfortable to like have guidelines. Like, you don't want that to be your role. And I hate being the police of anything as well. But what I noticed in that dialogue is like, these things are not equal. Like you're saying, I don't want to be the travel police because I don't want anybody to feel bad about what makes them happy. And then I'm on the other side saying, yes, but the trade-off is making someone feel bad, like hurting somebody's feelings maybe about what they like, versus another person's actual economic livelihood and another person's like life. Like, these two things are not equal. I'm like, I'm sorry I hurt your feelings, but this person lost 3 days of work, or, you know, something like that. Like, they're not equal topics. And so I think it's okay to, like, hurt somebody's feelings if the backside or the upside of that is that they don't make, you know, some very poor choices that actually affect people on a much larger scale.
So what are those poor choices that you see? Like, what have you seen that you feel is kind of egregious in terms of things people might do unconsciously, but they sort of visit a coffee producer and then take all their time and take them away from their work?
Yeah, I think that part feels like it deserves a lot more examination. I mean, you mentioned it, I think, I don't know if it was in the podcast or at least in a private message to me, about if the reverse was true. So if I'm a coffee buyer and I'm buying a handful of bags, 5, 10, and I'm coming to visit a producer, but I'm staying for 3 or 4 days and I'm staying in their house and they're feeding me 3 meals a day. Maybe I come with a friend. Maybe there's two of us. And now you're feeding us and we're here. And maybe we've bought coffee before. Maybe they haven't even made the purchase. They're just interested. They're like, I just want to get to know you. That is very, very common. I see that a lot. And a lot of producers are very happy to share their business. Like, they don't usually have a lot of these opportunities to access new markets. So they can be really excited about it. But if we do the reverse and we say, okay, Tom, someone's going to come visit you and they're going to stay in your house and you have to feed them and you have to drop everything that you're doing for 3 days. Can your business afford that? And the other way, it's like, that's a very unrealistic request for your time and taking you away from other things. But when we apply it to coffee, we're like, no, we feel a little bit of entitlement of like, well, I'm coming all this way and they're going to host me. And I don't know that we spend enough time asking or like really thinking about what are we asking of people? What are we asking of our hosts to do? We're asking them to not do anything else. We're asking them to not tend to other things. We're asking them to drive us, Ed.
Yeah, I mean, you brought this up in one of your podcasts, and it made me think, because it just was about the impact on somebody else's life, and would I be able to host someone in that same way? So if somebody came to visit me in Oakland and stayed at my house, which the dogs would not like, and then, you know, came to work, and I couldn't do what I normally could do, I could not offer in a reciprocal way what I was asking of them when I came there to visit them in a producing country. So yeah, it seems really unfair and really unequal. And I think, you know, a lot of where I would like to get to is a way that neither party patronizes each other, that we, you know, you really feel like you as a coffee buyer have this specific role and they produce the product that you buy. And it's very simple. If we could take maybe even some of the emotion out of it, and also just some of this kind of whole coffee family thing, and those things that kind of soft focus what the economic basis is for what we do. I visit you to confirm quality and to learn, you know, and at the same time, you have a business that you need to focus on, and your part, you know, somebody who produces coffee, they have their role, and you sort of meet equally. Like, I'm not helping you because I buy your product. There are other buyers, and if your product is good, you will have other buyers. So it's not really, I mean, I like that it's personal, but it's not, in a way, too. I think if people produce quality coffee, then they don't need me. Solely me, and they don't rely on me, and I, you know, vice versa. And I think that gives both parties a more honest basis for relating to each other and a more stable basis. And it's really not patronizing, because that's what I find in a lot of the dialogue of marketing coffee and selling coffee. It overrepresents and distorts the relationship. And I thought of a new one today, in fact, because I was here and I thought about coffee sourcing. I was thinking about all the work that I don't do to get my coffee. What I really do is I select the coffees that are offered to me, but someone else has done the work to put together all those selections and put them in front of me. Fetishize the whole world of coffee buyer to this point where it just sounds like you're just you know, this amazing wizard going out conjuring up these things. And you know, it's just fake. Like we say, I work with this producer. You didn't work with them. Cause like I've said, you don't work with the person you buy tomatoes from at the Berkeley organic market. You just went and bought their tomatoes. That's not working with them. And I think a lot of the things I was talking about in that podcast is how, you know, a group of coffee buyers will show up and then magically all, I'm being snarky here, by the way, all their Instagrams show as if they were there alone. It's like, you know, there's one group photo, but everyone goes off into the bushes and records their video. I'm here at this place. And, you know, you'd think they walked there or something. I also thought about how momentary my visits to coffee locations are, like the washing stations I went to in the last couple of days. I'm there for 30 minutes, 5 minutes. And I do try to get a lot out of that. I try to gather a lot of information. I take a lot of photos. I ask questions. I make notes. I fill in any details I might have missed from previous trips. But it's 30 and 45 minutes, and it gets represented like I'm, you know, there for these submersive encounters with them. So I feel like a lot of the language and stuff, the way people represent coffee travel is really fake, basically.
Well, and I think this is another opportunity to talk about that, like time, how time distorts our perception of what's important. And so, yes, if you're visiting for 30, 40 minutes and you're also having these discrete times, and then I could see how another buyer is like, well, is this really an issue? Like, I can't relate to this, you know, kind of having that barrier. Whereas I've only been to Kigali once, and I was there for 18 days working with a producer. So I was there for the 18 days watching all of these tour buses of the people that were coming for 30 minutes and 45 minutes. And over 18 days, like, I could see the growing pile of these interactions and experiences. And so, you know, we're colors very much kind of my snarkiness and my frustration with the system, just seeing how those trips developed, like you said, the representation of them, and then seeing all of the mm-hmm. things, being there for all of the things that the visitors don't get to see, or, you know, being there for the show, and then, okay, the show's over, everybody goes home, and like, we're still there working until whatever time, or all of those other kind of components. So that's why I think this is a really important topic to talk about and to bring up. And I'm okay having a little, like, I want to figure out how to say this. Like, I don't want to shame people either, but I'm okay if that's kind of an effect of what these conversations do. I'm okay if somebody listens to this and is maybe a little bit ashamed about, like, wow, I've done that and I never thought about the other side, or I'm about to do that. How do I make sure my trip doesn't turn into one of these things? Because I think awareness is really important, but it's not enough. It's just kind of having that sort of secondary action. So I also wanted to say that I really appreciate what you mentioned about depersonalizing coffee. And I feel like we have this false sense in specialty coffee that the way to make it specialty is more personal, more stories, more emotion, more connection. But I completely agree with you that can translate so often into this patronizing form. And it's like, it's perfectly dignified to say, I like this thing and I paid for it and now it's over here. Like, that's not less than, like, that's a perfectly valid economic exchange of like an mm-hmm. event. So all that to say, that's why I really wanted to have this conversation with you, because I think we have similar perspectives, but we're coming from really different like sides of the supply chain, really different sides of the industry. We have mm-hmm. you know, different kinds of experience, but I feel like with enough time, I think most reasonable people with enough time in this industry will converge to this type of perspective. But I don't know that we have that much time. And if we can accelerate some of these conversations, I think that's what I really want to accomplish in general. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if there's anything you want to add or react to there.
Well, I really want to hear more about what you have to say, because you are involved, you consult in production. And I visit people who are doing work in coffee for long periods of time before I come and are ready to present that coffee to me. But it's, you know, out of politeness, it's, And perhaps, you know, they I don't know, there, maybe they also believe some of this too, that a green buyer is really special, but they treat us very nicely and they don't want to be rude. And I think you mentioned just politeness, but you can't, it's very hard to get people to be critical, you know, for this politeness factor, which I totally respect, but I want somebody to tell me, you know, honestly, how does this work? Like, what is your view? How is it when you keep seeing this stream of buyers come through? It's something I really don't get to see. But what I have experienced on the tour buses and when I sit still and see streams of buyers come through is it's not very flattering sometimes. So I want to hear more about what you see because you're willing to talk about it. And, you know, generally in coffee, I just find people aren't critical enough because A, they think critical is bad. And B, it's like this is just like a business. So if you have a business and you criticize another business, you're just trying to elevate yourself over other people. But it leads to this real silence in coffee about, you know, if people have products to sell and they have reputations, they don't want them damaged. They don't want to speak too much critically about how people are behaving. So I totally agree. And I think it comes down to me to like harm, like what harm comes to a coffee buyer who's hurt because their ego isn't stroked. Their ego isn't flea combed.
Yes.
You know, versus somebody, yeah, they've lost several days of work and then find out that this person really isn't a serious buyer and they're not really committed to long-term, you know, buying relationship or something. You know, what kind of harm, you know, so it's, I think of that too. Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know. The more you say about what you have observed, I think the richer it is because you've been in production situations, you've seen people pass through and you've noticed things. And what are those things?
Well, I also have this, I think we share this like super critical voice that is like censoring our comments frequently. And I have a hard time with that voice because I do get to see those things. So I can speak on behalf of producers, but I don't think that's helping either. Like I don't want to speak for them because then I'm just part of the problem. So kind of with that in mind, you know, I guess that's another thing too, is that I would say most producers wouldn't be this critical. Most producers wouldn't get as upset as I get in these situations because I think they're much more culturally used to it, or, you know, they don't have that lens of like, you know, what someone just did to them was rude. So it just kind of like, you know, slides off their back and I'm there observing it. I'm like, that was incredibly rude. So like, I'm more upset than the producer. So I don't want to say that like, there's some, you know, they're there fuming and they're just like not able to say anything. And I'm kind of observing this. I think most of the time they're just not really incorporating because cultures are different. So they may not have perceived the slight that I perceive, kind of being one foot in both worlds. But what I will say is that I think that one of the things that most, I think, conscientious buyers like you would say, you know, if a producer said, you know, this is not a great time for me, can we do it next month? Or, you know, please come visit me, but I can't have you stay in my house. Can we find some other accommodation for you? Or yes, you can visit me, but would you be willing to cover your own meals for this time? Like, I'm sure every reasonable green buyer would be like, of course I would do that. Like, that's a perfectly reasonable request. But culturally, mm-hmm. living in Latin cultures, that is not something that we would request of visitors. Like, we have a very special place for visitors and they are very special entities that come visit. So that, I don't know, I guess it's sort of like you're saying with green buyers, if someone asked us these things, of course we would do them. And I'm like, I just don't see a world where producers would actually set limits and put, you know, regulations. So I think it's a much more on the part of the green buyer to ask those questions for themselves and kind of censor themselves and say, is what I'm asking pretty reasonable? Could we flip this in another way? And then instead of waiting to be asked, offering, saying, can I cover my meals? Would it be okay for me to stay with you? Or I'm perfectly happy finding accommodations nearby. Or, you know, offering these things that maybe producers are definitely not going to be the first ones to suggest that. But maybe once it's presented to them, or maybe not even saying like, you know, maybe they'll still say yes and like, be really gracious, but maybe it makes mm-hmm. more sense for me as a visitor to like stay in my own place and not invade their home and something like that. Like, I think the effort needs to be disproportionately on the visitor to try to be a good visitor instead of disproportionately on the host to be a good host. That makes sense.
I've been trying for like 26 years to figure this out. So, and I don't, you know, I know I've done every bad thing because, you know, my head gets filled up with ideas about, you know, a lot of times I think like, you know, especially in the period about 10 years ago and stuff when like green buying competition was just kind of ridiculous. It was like this, especially, I hate to say it was like a man thing. It was like a competition. And it really felt weird. And I know even at the time, I really had trouble with it, but I also just couldn't, like, there was a culture around it that was really gross to me. And I reflect back on that. And some trips I take where I, you know, I know I was just trying to not be bored and have fun, but I get really silly. And I think I was really rude sometimes, you know? And I feel like I've, you know, probably done every bad thing that there is to do in it, and not be out of intention, but usually just out of ignorance and not being aware of what people are doing for me. But the thing I thought of when you're talking is there's a guy that loaned us a truck in Ethiopia like a couple months ago for a whole week, and I didn't thank him. So that's what I thought of. I need to remember to thank him. Maybe I did, but I didn't like formally thank him. So
yeah, and I think that's what a lot of people don't realize that I'm able to perceive is how much producers give. Like, it's not just their time where they're not working or doing anything else, where they're attending to the guests, and then it can be, okay, they're home, so maybe, you know, the kids have to, the three kids are sleeping in one room so that the guests can have one of the kids' rooms, something like that. And then of course the food, so the time of the women to cook all of the food and then to clean all your dishes. And then I've seen so many people get their laundry done, so now they're washing your clothes and they're cooking your food and you're taking their room in their house, and they picked you up from the airport and they lend you a car and they fill the gas with that car, so you're not paying them back for the gas of the car or any other like things like breakdowns or things like that. So I think when you start adding up all of these little things, and you're like, well, I just visited them for 3 days or 4 days. And then you think, okay, but 10 other people came to visit them. Or like all of these things are quite a burden. It's not just your footprint, but like the footprint of everybody in that space who can take advantage in this way.
Yeah, I think, you know, leading with, you know, with a clear idea, giving someone a clear idea of this is what I'm doing, this is how much coffee I'm looking for, you know, that you have an organized way that you present them with what your need is. And so at least that part is clear. So, you know, I mean, I do think the producers will make their own choices to some degree. And but I have seen times where I just can't believe the resources that somebody buying 10 bags is getting. And, you know, I mean, a lot of times they're real, you know, sort of well-traveled exporters and people who are showing off coffee to people. They've gotten a lot better at being set up for this because they've been through it so much that they are basically going to stage that circus, you know, 5 days of a week. Like in Antigua, there's exporters that have like cupping rooms with dividing things between them so they can just stack up the visitors and, you know, they can all get their work done. But it's really important to know what is that work, what are they being asked for, and to have to present them with a clear idea of how much you buy, what you are looking for, what, you know, maybe even pricing, this is what I've been paying, etc.
And I think, you know, one of the conversations that we've had, you know, in the background is having some kind of guideline, which is, I think, too strong of a word, but just questions that one can ask oneself before embarking on a trip. And I think one of those could be, what you're saying is really important, is how much coffee am I buying? So maybe it's 10 bags. And then say, okay, what is this trip going to cost just me? So saying like, maybe there's two of us and it's going to be $2,000 or $3,000 on tickets. And then there's still like the Uber is kind of going back and forth, or whatever these like other expenses could be. And then say, okay, what's better? And again, I'm always very biased for the producer to say, what if we took those $3,000, like didn't do a trip, and then paid them 50 cents more per pound on the coffee? Like, what would make a bigger difference? And then you can still go on the trip, but just be really honest and say, no, I'm going on the trip so I can get that picture of me and I can say I've been there to say that we like work with the producers versus like taking that money and just paying them a little bit more when you have 10 bags. I think that when you are buying containers, when you're buying 250 bags, when you're buying multiple containers, understanding the logistics of the country, like that could be, it could be really beneficial and really important that you go and you meet with people and that you're cupping through, you know, 75 lots that are going to be filling this container. Like there's always, I guess what I want to say is I don't think that travel is never necessary. I don't, there, I know that there are things that cannot be accomplished in a Zoom call, but a lot of things can. And so if you're selling the story of, you know, we're working with these partners and we're valuing the producer, but you're spending thousands of dollars to visit them instead of paying more for coffee, okay, that's not really that helpful to them.
Yeah, I mean, I've never used, you know, WhatsApp and Zoom and et cetera as well as I could have. I mean, there's so much communication that could happen, and you can ask people for photos that you would like for marketing even, or hey, can you show me your new pulper? You don't have to fly to go see it. So I don't think, I think there's such an amazing resource, and everybody, most people can connect that way. And I think would be happy with your questions and to give you information and material. And I've never really been that good at that. I also kind of conversely, I hope we're not getting into this thing where you're like the representative for producers and I'm a representative for consumers, but I think about the cost to like my customers, because my view of myself, which like I try to just think of myself as a personal shopper, like I'm going out to find really good coffee. I don't want to pay ridiculous prices. I do negotiate on prices. I think people are somehow embarrassed of that, but I do, because, you know, and we find a fair thing. That's a part of respecting somebody else's business and they have mine. And then we find a place that works and we buy coffee. But, you know, when I'm doing that, I'm having to tag on the price of every trip to our expenses. And that increases our cost to our customers. So, you know, I do feel a responsibility to them as well. And I think of that when it gets just really crazy in coffee, like at SCA, I just cannot believe these booths and these parties and these like things people do. And it's like the roasters all go and they party and stuff. And it's just like, dude, you're all paying for that. That's like, you know, in fact, what really sucks is the people who don't go and they don't even go to the party and get the free beer and they're paying for it. Like where does all that money come from? It comes from you on the cost of your coffee. And so then I think, well, where do you want that to go? Would you rather have a really efficient business where you go, you know, they don't have an extravagant booth and a huge party at SCA, but they're really conscious of what they're paying and transparent about what they're paying producers. And then that's, you know, something really good you can take to your consumers, you know, your clients. So where do you want the money to go? It's something I think about along those lines.
No, and that's funny too, because I think it's another like example of converging on kind of the same point from different sides, where it's like that money trip could either be used to pay better prices for the coffee, or it could be used to, you know, pass on those savings or not necessarily pass them on, but not add them to your customers. You know, that cup of coffee doesn't have to be that price because it doesn't have to cover all of your travel.
I wanted to mention too, I think back to all these kind of gross trips I took or things that, you know, I feel like, what kind of tourist have I been and how have I been a tourist? And then I had the experience yesterday because I'm in Rwanda and I went out for a day and it was kind of cool because I realized that a lot of what I end up doing is really working with the person who's driving me around and the agronomist that's with me and kind of learning from them. And also like we went to, like our whole day was kind of actually fairly blown after we went to this really remote station we've been buying from for a lot of years and then had to meet these local officials. And I wasn't quite clear on what was going on because I don't speak Kenya or Rwanda. And we ended up having to have a dinner and it wasn't, you know, stay and be polite. And I just, you know, did my job of just being there. And when we got back in the car and drove and we got super late to the hotel, So I was a little like, well, what was that all about? And he was like, you know, this was really important. We needed to talk to this sector official because we're really trying to get them to support the stations in the area and make sure that their policies for the farmers are going to lead to some parity in terms of the other sectors. And he said a couple times about how what an important meeting that was for him. And I thought about this way that in a way, you know, this person is my agent here. They do work that benefits me, and it benefits them and their company, and it benefits hopefully the coffee sector and the farmers and the station co-ops or the owners. But it was really, I was sort of backseat on this whole thing, but it was really interesting. And I was on somebody else's trip with somebody else's agenda. And that's an experience in my coffee travel a lot too. And it's quite different from me being sort of, you know, the center and things being there to service me and my interests and what I'm trying to do. So there's a cooperation that happens when you especially start to acknowledge the role, like I don't source coffee, I just select it. They do, they actually source coffee, you know, and realizing that you have an important part as a buyer, but it's just a part, it's a small part. And the more you sort of see the picture of how things work and acknowledge your small part in it, I think, you know, it changes, things shift a little. So that was something.
I really liked your analogy of a personal shopper, because that's how I like to feel. That's how I kind of treat my coffee buying experience. So like I know, or I've learned, you know, I've tried a lot of different roasters. I really like Sweet Bloom in Colorado. So I don't have to spend what I know is like, okay, that's my personal shopper. So I know that coffees that they have and the roast level that they have, like I'm probably going to like 9 out of 10 coffees. So it's really easy for me to just like find something and get mm-hmm. it. It's a little bit more, I don't know, like I don't want to think so much about everything all of the time. Like I'd like some things to be easy. So if I can find some things like that, like I know I'm going to get good quality from here because I have this experience, and then that's a value add for me. And so I think mm-hmm. that for roasters to think of themselves in that way is really wonderful and it's really helpful. And I think that, I don't know, I feel like we can also extend this into, I want to extend this into producers, but I feel like they don't get that opportunity, because I had this question asked of me recently about a winemaker and how winemakers are able to have like their style, like their imprint on the wine, and how coffee producers, we really tend to talk more about the variety or the process and, or, you know, farming practices. And we don't really mm-hmm. let them have a chance to have like their style or their imprint on a particular coffee. So they're not really allowed to participate in that way of this, like, this is just a style that I like, and that people would come to this coffee producer for this style. We're really most like, oh, do you have this SL28, or do you have this geisha, or are you, you know, whatever, are you doing carbonic mm-hmm. maceration? So I don't know. I feel like we know that this is a valuable role, and I'm just very aware that we don't extend that option to a lot of producers. What do you think about that?
I mean, well, yes, I do think about that. I think that, you know, when the story about coffee used to be like, oh, terroir and oh, variety, that it removed human labor. It removed labor and the many decisions that producers make. You know, they may not go pick the coffee themselves, or many times they do, or it's a family member or a neighbor they hire. You know, in Colombia, for example, here in Rwanda or Burundi, they have 400 trees. They just do it all themselves. And other places, they're maybe directing, you know, their crew, like in a big farm in Antigua. But, you know, the selection of coffee cherry and the quality control with coffee cherry, to me, really does amount to something that becomes, you know, it's so critical, and it's something you can never fix later. I mean, working backwards from the roaster, like roasters and baristas and everything, I've always been amazed how you take this agricultural product and it goes through this whole system of homogenization in order to reach a quality level where we put it into these machines, roasting machines and brewing machines, and we produce something predictable. and the technification, like instrumentation with all of that, is where a lot of the focus is right now. You know, that I was trying to say in that podcast how it's shifted, I think, recently into these sort of technical aspects. And people are like mentioning this coffee is from this farm, but they're not talking anymore about it. They're kind of like saying, and this is my method, and this is what I'm doing. This is my roast curve, and this is the little flick at the end, and this is how I'm controlling it. So, but it's really the homogenization that starts from that thing that comes off the tree through the mill and the processing and the dry mill that makes all that possible. And I feel like that's the basis that we work off of. And we treat it in a way that's so mechanistic that it takes out so much of the, you know, hand-to-eye work of people choosing that coffee and then going out and laying it out and picking it out. And, you know, and even like subtle things here, I don't know what you call them in Guatemala, pintones or, mm-hmm. you know, they call them camagua, the half red, half green. And some of them are totally ripe, you know, and you feel them and you can tell the difference between the pinton or the half green, half red, that's actually like a really good coffee cherry and should go into the process, and ones that are not. And those are, you know, there's a feel for it, I think, that's maybe not fully understood or respected.
I've seen that also in drying. I've seen guys that work on patios and just they put the seeds in their teeth to tell you how the moisture content. And they're just, you know, putting mm-hmm. it in their teeth, in their mouth. And then they're like, oh, it's like at 13%. And then I've seen them be so accurate. It's been really incredible. Like they just have that experience and that feel, that hands-onness is, I think, something that we undervalue. We think it's very, I don't know, like we like our tools, we like our toys. But I think one of the kind of hypocrisies in the coffee industry is that you mentioned, you know, I've seen this too, that it's very much about the tools and the toys, and we get very excited about that on the consuming end. But on the producing end, not only are we not necessarily aware of like how much labor it is, like we're kind of turning it into this other thing, but if we are, there seems to be a very negative reaction to producers getting better machines, to machine drying, to like kind of upgrading equipment. Like it's like, okay, you can have the fanciest roaster, but you want them still to pick by hand, and you want them to like dry in the sun, and you don't want them to have, you know, a mechanical dryer. And so I think there's like that hypocrisy of like, we can have all the toys, but we don't want producers to have the toys, because then the product doesn't seem authentic, and then it doesn't seem artisanal, and then it doesn't seem as handmade. And so there's very much this resistance, when the reality is that labor, not in Africa, but at least in Central America, it's incredibly scarce. There's a lot fewer coffee pickers, and that's a huge problem. And we're going to have to mechanize in some way, whether it's drones, whether it's mechanical harvesting, like we're going to have to do something, because the people aren't mm-hmm. there. And I don't think that they're going to come back. So I don't know. I just see, like, again, these double standards a lot on tools and toys.
Yeah, I think that one's complicated for me because, you know, on one hand, I do like the way coffee is produced traditionally, and I like where it comes from. And, you know, there's an image, there's the image of that and the reality of that. And it's coming into a clash in a lot of places in the world.
I want to go back to that where it's like, yes, we like the idea of handmade. Like, that's nice. It makes us feel good. But the other side of making us feel good means that you are limiting those opportunities for other people, or that they are not, because you're like, well, I'm not going to buy from people that are super mechanized, that are machine harvesting and machine drying. And, you know, I want this sort of element to it. And I think about that where it's like, I mean, everyone's entitled to their opinion and to their feelings, but just realizing that like your feelings are limiting options for other people. Like they're not just your feelings. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does for sure. And on that point, you know, I actually remember, I didn't listen to it, but you did the episode on Cometeer.
Yeah.
And about how you got this good coffee, but you just didn't like, I think, because I heard you mention something later, like you just didn't like the process of making a coffee this way.
Exactly.
It's just not attractive. And that's, I guess, part of what I'm thinking is that there's something kind of attractive to your mind about coffee. You know, I think the word sapid kind of is a word that invokes both taste and pleasing to the mind and to the senses. And, you know, I've thought about that before because, you know, we represent coffee is a place where people want to know the origin because it is pleasing. It is a beautiful place. You know, it does, you do get good pictures there. So it's not the place where we get our toaster oven from that we don't really want to know anything about that would disrupt our image of where this comes from and disrupt our enjoyment of it. So I just wanted to note, I mean, that comes up for me in it because both critically and also I'm kind of like, I feel it too. Like I listened to a presentation by a really technified food engineer, like a serious food engineer about coffee. I don't know if, I can't remember her name though. She's from Brazil. And it was just the most unappealing thing. And yet I knew like this is what coffee's been missing. Is the approach of a food engineer to look at inefficiencies in the system and to re-engineer the whole thing. And, you know, I just feel this like resistance to that, but I think you're focused on a really interesting point here between the representation of coffee and why it's pleasing. And then, but this production system doesn't totally work in a lot of places. It's sort of crumbling and falling apart more in some places than others. And labor is the biggest issue, I think, in this. So there really isn't a way if we don't get that good material, there's no way to fix it later with all our fantastic techniques and inventions. We have to have a pretty good material going in. And, you know, mechanical drying and more automation and stuff could give us at least a good baseline, you know, 85 point, 84 point coffee that could be scaled up and produced, you know, much more efficiently. But it's not very pleasing to see that done, like in Brazil.
Well,
in some ways,
I love that you brought up my own comment to your example because I think you're right. That's exactly how I was framing that product, where it was a technically beautiful cup of coffee. Like I would have this coffee in front of me and I'm like, wow, this is objectively a very sweet, balanced, complex, very well crafted beverage in front of me. But because all I did was like open up a thing and pour it in, I'm like, I'm not enjoying this experience. So yes, there was something missing that is not just the outcome, but some of that journey has to be part of it to really enjoy kind of the whole experience. So like for me, making my pour over is part of it. I'd rather have a less technically perfect cup that I made myself than someone just like, you know, puts a pill in front of me and they're like, here you go. And yeah, so I completely understand that handmade crafting is an important element. However, with the Cometeer example, this is a business that, you know, it has millions of investment money. Like, I don't know what kind of, you know, like for me, they're not hurting. Like this is just a creative business that was interesting. Like they decided to make something versus talking about producers who own land who like have much fewer options. And so in that sense, like I'm admitting that I feel this way, but I would also be willing to put that aside and say, if this is what it takes to keep coffee going, because I think that's the thing. It's like, I think a lot of people think that, you know, mechanical harvesting is like a preference. It's like, well, I'd rather have somebody handpick my coffee than machine harvest it. But if the option is machine harvested or no coffee, farms are completely abandoned, like no one's around, like that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about this like, oh, this would be nice to have. I'm like, the people are leaving. The people are, especially in Guatemala and Honduras, they're going to the United States. You know, like there are entire towns where there's just only women because all of the men left, and there is not this labor. And so I just think it's kind of a disconnect that we're sitting here thinking, oh, I don't like machine harvested coffee. And I'm like, that's not, that's like so far from what I'm talking about. I don't care if you like it. That's just what we're facing in a lot of places because of kind of the other economic and political landscape.
Yeah. I mean, I do think in each producing country, you know, it's really heterogeneous in terms of what they're actually facing and, you know, land pressure, urbanization, migration, you know, all of these things are different in each place. So, you know, yes, in Ethiopia, you may have plenty of labor for a while, and there may be a really different set of issues facing coffee, but they're there nonetheless in some form or other. You know, I mean, I'm just saying, I guess technology doesn't sort of, isn't applied equally everywhere all the time. And then the issues that people face are kind of different everywhere. And I wanted to say that because I think that when we think of what is done on the consuming side, like Comatier, I mean, that kind of an effort, if that failed tomorrow, people would just write off their investment money and go on. It's no big deal. And I think that's part because it's capital fluidity. If you have a farm and you got that farm from your family or you bought it, but it's your land, you can't pick it up and move it. You can't switch over into another crop immediately. You don't have fluidity in terms of capital. You know, maybe you can loan money against it, but in a lot of places you can't. And a lot of times the loans you get are really huge pressure on coffee producers, you know, especially if they're buying any coffee from their neighbors or need to finance anything or any improvement. That's another thing. But on the consuming side, we can just sort of like change our minds tomorrow about anything, you know, and it doesn't really matter that much. So I see that as, it's something I think about in terms of how what may be familiar to us. There's just not this parity between consuming and producing in this way.
Definitely. But I do appreciate you bringing up that example, because we also had another situation, because you and I have been going back and forth on tourism and kind of the pros and cons. And I don't want to come out as like anti-coffee travel. I just am pro thoughtful coffee travel. And like I said, I still think that there are times when it is a great value add for both parties to have coffee travel. But I think that that's the exception, not the rule. I think, like I said, a lot of trips could be shortened, avoided, or kind of changed in different ways. But then you also mentioned, well, I'm hosting fermentation camps now. And you said that seems like advanced travel. And I loved his comment so much. It's so good. It's so good. Because
why?
Because it's true. Because in many ways, I felt really seen. I felt like you are paying attention. And so when you have, you know, some feedback like that, I'm like, okay, somebody's paying attention. Like, I don't get to get away with anything. And I think that what I want to say about the fermentation camp as advanced tourism is it can be many things at once. It is advanced tourism. And I also see it as like a professional opportunity, because I am trying to focus on coffee producers. So our quota has been, we're at like 53% coffee producer attendance. So we're more than half coffee producer attendance, and most of those are female coffee producers. I'm very selective about who gets accepted. You don't just buy a ticket and you automatically get a spot. I have also because of our sleeping arrangement, so I have a quota of how many female to male participants and how many, you know, producers I want. So there's like things that I'm trying to do to mitigate. But at the end of the day, you're right. You know, the people that aren't coffee producers, that aren't coming for professional development to learn these skills, we do have like 2% that have been, I call them normies, coffee people that just like love coffee. Because everybody that comes is usually a producer, a roaster, exporter, importer. But we've had, you know, there's a couple of people who are just like, I'm a teacher and I love coffee. And they come and they spend the week with us and they get to do coffee processing and meet all of these people. But for me, that was such a huge value add for the coffee producers to meet with the final consumer, to like get to meet somebody who loves coffee so much that they can take a week off work or their lives and come and like sit next to them and learn and talk and do all of these things. So for me, there's still a lot of value in including those like non-professional, non-coffee professionals, but still like coffee enthusiasts into the mix. So I don't know if that sounds a little defensive on my part for the camps, but you know, it's like trying to do something. And I think the other thing is that there is really a gap for a producer focused event. I have a lot of interest in this because most of the kind of events like this are more consumer or roaster focused, and there's not as many options for producers. They don't have as many means to go traveling all over, but still just something that's very focused on production.
Yeah, I mean, that's funny. I think there is really interesting forms of tourism that are really in depth, really educational, and perhaps challenging. And, you know, some of the way people encounter each other across this huge divide in a lot of things, from production to consumption, you know, I think people become genuinely very curious about what the other side looks like. And I remember a really terrible thing I did for outing ourselves, which is I remember this coffee producer. I mean, I don't feel that bad because he's kind of a snarky guy, but I was looking at his Instagram over his shoulder when I was visiting him in Burundi, and it's like all latte art and cafes and people doing pour. And I just can't stand this stuff, honestly. Like, I don't need to see how you do this thing for the umpteenth time. You know, it just is like, I mean, it's just not for me. I have to filter it out because it's just kind of boring, and I've seen it. And he was like, yeah, but you know, I don't get to see this. This is exactly what they're like so curious about what people are doing with coffee because it's something he doesn't get to see. I mean, he had a cafe and stuff, so he's not like, you know, a producer that just grows coffee. But I realized people just do become very curious. And people ask me a lot of really interesting questions when I travel about what they want to know, what we're doing, how things are going, how we show the coffee. Like, and I try to just do a good job explaining that to them. I used to print out the pages of our website that show how we're talking about their coffee so they could keep that and have a copy of it, and kind of try to fill in whatever gap I can for people. But I also just want to mention, I just started a book, but I had to leave it at home because it's too thick. And it's a cultural anthropologist who really took on tourism as something to study. And when you think about the history of anthropology, anthropologists, in a sense, in the 1920s were like tourists in the 2000s, you know, they studied people in a particular way that was kind of just straightforward and very naive. He found himself starting to watch how tourists watched the people that were the toured people, you know, and that's why, where, you know, the producer as the toured and the coffee buyer as the tourist, you know, that sort of divide. The interesting thing is he actually was solicited. He wrote all these critical books and developed a lot of the ideas about tourist activity. But then he was invited by this sort of New York City tour company that sort of had fancy tours to go to Indonesia and to tour a lot of Indonesia, where he was a specialist and spoke Bahasa with tourists. And what he would do were all these really interesting things where, like, for example, they would go to Yogyakarta and they would observe the tourists would go and they would go for a Balinese dance that was like a traditional Balinese dance, supposedly. And then he would give a small lecture about the dance they'd watch. And he would say, well, this dance is in traditional costumes, but it was actually created in 1970 and it was created for visitors. You know, so what you perceived as authentic here was something that was, you know, was made for you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now it's become this, they've done it. And then what he would do is Javanese costume on. So with paint, they would come out and he would introduce them and they would sit down and talk to the tourists without paint and be like, I'm a student. I dance. My aunt did this same dance in the 70s, and now I'm doing it. This was in the 90s. And he staged all these very interesting interventions where people got to see how they observed things and kind of also see them in a more complex light. And he got kicked off the tour because the owner of the company came along on the trip and didn't like what he was doing. And so he basically had to stay in the back and not talk. But it was a very funny introduction to his book. And it reminds me of what's possible, though, when you bring people together. You know, I think what is possible with what you're doing, you know, can have interventions like that that are really interesting.
No, I appreciate that. And I think it also makes me remember the dangerous grounds that you brought up in your podcast episode and the Travel Channel. This idea of like the coffee hunter and like the travel for adventure and like the caricature I'd never heard of Dangerous Grounds, but you played the trailer, and then I Googled it, and I was like 10 seconds in, and it says, what did you say? It said, I started with nothing and built my company from the ground up. It was like the first 10 seconds. And I'm just like, you were born a white male in America speaking English. You weren't born with nothing. You were born with like the lottery. And so I actually couldn't watch the rest of the video. But it's interesting that that was in 2012. And I was hoping that that would be like a much more outdated like mentality. Mm-hmm. But I'm surprised at how many, like I just ran across a new company from 2023 that calls themselves Coffee Hunters. And they're still like, I don't know, we're not leaving that as far behind as I would hope by now, more than a decade on. So it's still much more prevalent. And maybe, you know, I'm sensitive to it, so it pops up for me more frequently. But I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, kind of your experience with the adventure and the caricature.
Yeah, I mean, in that podcast, I referenced this crazy text from a Starbucks package from the 90s, I think from the 90s or early 2000s, you know, of this coffee hunter thing. And it's really funny. Dub Hay. The biggest thing on there, I've thought of that for years, because, and it'd be a joke if I was traveling with someone, because I turn to them and I'd say, I think this is as far as the National Geographic people went, you know, like we're going beyond where the National Geographic people went, which is like, we've outmanned you, you know, we're more, and it's just like that. It's so bad. But what I do feel, and then I tried to cite a current example, which I don't know if I should have done. I felt a little bad about looking at someone's site, but it's this thing where people really just try hard. They really want something to be the way they want it to be. And today I even read an Instagram post, and it was about a farm that I know and a farm owner I know. And he's kind of, you know, between you and me, he's not the greatest guy. And, you know, he's just lauded in this post about his bravery and all he's done for the community. And it's like, man, it's hard to read. It's a very, very long text about how caring and sensitive he's been and how it's been a tough relationship with the community and stuff. And it's like, yeah, because he's kind of a dick, and that's why it's tough. And so, you know, sometimes you get a peek into it like that. And you wonder, and you just feel like, you know, just like in a tourist narrative, in a way, people, the place that they go, it's only the last step of a story that's already been written, you know, that you anticipate it, and then you just go and you see, and it's fulfilled. And then, you know, if it's not totally fulfilled, you write a little bad review of something, and, you know, TripAdvisor. But it's like, it's how much we fulfill the wish that we've just already had for a place to already be what we expect it to be. And I feel like in coffee, in marketing, and a lot of what I feel I brought to coffee for a long time and still do, you know, it's still there, is just wanting to see what you want to see and not see what you don't want to see. But always wondering, you know, am I still just being guided by narratives that I don't recognize as easily as the ones I can look back 5 or 10 years and see. And I think 5 or 10 years ago, let's say, it was the height of this, really people competing to go find the best coffee. And it was so full of itself. And I think it's passed on. But what I guess what I've seen is that a lot of people look to the United States independent coffee roaster scene as being some sort of model. And, you know, I mean, I remember in San Francisco, like people would just come, as far as from little anecdotal things, they'd be like visitors every week in Ritual and Four Barrel and these companies. And they'd be like, I'm going to go do this in my place where I'm from, you know? And so it seeded this idea about how you behave in coffee, how you interact, how you source coffee. There's a lot of this modeling that goes on. It's a lot of high school, like, you know, you look at what they're wearing, and then you sort of figure out, I'm going to mix those two, and that's going to be me. And there's a lot of that. And so I think it spreads, and I think it's something to call out because I think there are problems with it. And there's, you know, problems with the way people travel, people encounter other cultures they're not familiar with. Some of those are very understandable, just feeling overwhelmed, feeling at risk, feeling a need to comfort yourself or whatever when you're traveling. But it leads to attitudes and behaviors that are, you know, I think should be looked at. So,
yeah, I really like what you said about the kind of copy and paste behavior that I see a lot too in coffee. And I think that that's why, well, so trying to have this conversation where you're right, it's like, it's tricky because you don't want to shame people because that very few people learn from shame, but it is important to kind of call out and note this behavior and say like, how can we talk about this without saying, okay, we're not trying to shame you, but if, but there's problematic behavior here. And if this is what's going to be copy and pasted and like taken and transformed and morphed into other things, like it has at its core just some kind of problematic messaging. So if it's going to get amplified, we're going to just amplify that problematic behavior even more. And something that I've noticed, especially about coffee culture that you also mentioned, is I also grew up in the Bay Area and now I live in Antigua, and the coffee shops that have popped up here, it just really feels like a copy of like, oh, I could be in LA right now, or I could be in Berkeley. Like everything just feels borrowed, and like maybe 5% Guatemalan. Like there doesn't seem to be that much of an influence. Like it just, especially because Antigua is a particularly tourist town. It's a particularly high traffic area. And so, and most, you know, the businesses are owned by foreigners. So it just, it feels very, I don't know. So then, you got even more tourists coming and they see like coffee culture in Guatemala, which is just a copy of coffee culture in the Bay Area. And I'm just like, I don't think you're really getting it's, yeah, it's like this like kind of self-fulfilling cycle of like, oh, this is what it is here. So if I go make it over there, it's more authentic to what I saw in a producing country or an origin country. And I'm like, no, that's borrowed from your own like consuming culture. So it's like this like really like tangled yarn.
Well, in the defense of that, that's, you know, that kind of cultural pastiche that always sort of happens and things are borrowed and copied. And sometimes crazy new things come out of it, but not if the copy is too, if there's this kind of just, I don't know, well, you call it like cultural hegemony, where there's somebody sets the standard and then people just fawn to that and try to borrow it and try to look like it. And that never works. But I do, I mean, well, there's Café Noce, which is like my favorite name in the world. I just really like that.
That's where
that
I got engaged, Café Noce.
Really?
Yes. So Nick and I had a little too much to drink and we're like, we should get married, right? He's like, yeah. And then it's like another drink. And then Café Noce was closed. They closed for the pandemic and they just reopened like a couple weeks ago. Oh. They've been closed for like 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, there's place. Like, the one of the best things that happens where people, I guess, sort of imitate something is they actually get it really wrong and it becomes this other thing. Yeah. I mean, they get it right and getting it wrong. And, you know, I think that's really interesting. And I think also, you know, what I hope you see in Indonesia is people really just going to other extremes with coffee that I don't like and I don't want to drink, but it's like they like it. And it's the way they consume it is totally different. Like these super ridiculous whiny coffees that, you know, you just drink a thimbleful with friends and you're like, you order the crazy thing on the menu and you all sit with a little carafe around the table at night and you share this, you know, because they, you know, a lot of places it's not alcohol. And this becomes a very social drink that's about experiencing some wild taste. And like, that's coffee? Oh my God. And, you know, people take it to a different place in a different cultural, you know, a different situation of serving it and preparing it. And then I think it's great. And if it excludes me and my sensibility, fine. I think that's where it starts to become something new because it doesn't refer to how they do it somewhere else that, you know, was influential on you or you copied. Maybe really neat things will come out of like local cultures where those guys actually do say, I work with the farmer. Yeah, like they went up the week before and they helped ferment the lot that they're going to buy. And they're going to go pick it up and bring it down. And that's amazing. I'm also, can I just mention fresh coffee? Like what people can do with coffee that's not a seed that's supposed to last 6 or 8 months, but like is only 2 weeks off the tree. Like what are the new possibilities of people who can get coffee locally and actually work with a farm to do beverages that I don't even know what they are. So
I think that's a really good point. There's a lot of opportunity there. And I think most people don't realize the quality degradation that can happen when you spend 4 months in a container going across the world and then experience some shipping delays and you get stuck in a warehouse and coffee can get a lot of trauma on that road. So I wanted to ask you, so you've been traveling since 2001. I think you said that was when you had your first...
My very first trip.
Very first trip. So why do you keep traveling?
Well, I do enjoy it, and I do want to like try to keep enjoying it and find out what's enjoyable because it makes me want to keep doing what I do. And, you know, that is something I'm pretty committed to. You know, like I want coffee to be interesting to me. I know that sounds really self-centered, but I do find a lot of things with coffee really boring, and a lot of conversations that interest other people. And, you know, we did the SCA for the first time with our own booth, and we just went as our wacky selves, and we did an arts and crafts booth. And I know people are just like, whatever. I don't know what they thought, but
it was fun. What do you mean arts and crafts? Were you like painting macaroni on paper plates?
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't have macaroni, but we would have if I had thought of it. No, we just did all kinds of crazy things. I was trying to think of what can we do for people there? And they always have these stupid plastic badges. So I thought we could like bedazzle people's badges. They can come sit around a little table. We had a little table on the floor. You could sit down, and I just brought all my arts and crafts from home and glitter. Although glitter is actually not allowed in the convention center, but we did it anyway.
Scandal.
Yeah. And, you know, I missed the whole show, but when I just would get up and look around, I'm just not that interested in what I know a lot of people find really interesting. So, you know, part of it is just traveling and thinking about what is this all about? Like, what are we doing?
So why you know, did what you go to SCA? Did you feel pressure to just like show up and have a presence?
Yeah, I always feel like I should, you know, it's what you do. You should be there or something. And I went in the year before. I went as what I thought a true middle-aged man should dress at and look like. And it was totally weird. I just kind of do it the different thing each year, I guess, now. And this year was to actually have a booth and just actually, you know, have ourselves be seen, or you could come find us. And it was fun, and it was weird. And I think, you know, I think Sweet Maria's is such a weird little quirk in the coffee business. Like, I don't mind if we're kind of like seen as not serious and dismissible. Like, I brought my popcorn popper and roasted coffee, and all over there was people with like all these new amazing roasters that are like, they're all like $5,000 for, you know, the roast. And the Cafe Logic was there. That's a cool one. And a bunch of things. And people have gotten really good at this stuff, but you can still roast coffee in a popcorn popper, and it's pretty good. You know, I mean, so just wanted to show up as ourselves, I guess.
We have that in common for me and making coffee and fermenting coffee. I really like to use, you know, plastic buckets and like really minimal equipment, and just say like, making good coffee is really not that hard. Like we put this big circus and we make this like show of it. I'm like, it's good coffee. Yes. Exceptional coffee is hard, but good coffee, really not hard. We can make good coffee with very basic tools, very basic like principles, you know, short fermentation. Like it's really not that hard. We don't have to make ourselves crazy. regarding SEA, I think it's interesting that I had a lot of, because, you know, it's an important industry event and a lot of people go. So I was getting messages like, hey, are you going to be there? Are you doing anything? And I didn't go to SEA this year. I haven't been for many years, but every time I told somebody that I wasn't going, the overwhelming reaction was like, oh, lucky. Like, lucky that you can choose not to go. A lot of people were like, no, yeah, I wish I could stay, but I got to do this. So I was just wondering if that was kind of, you know, you felt this pressure to show up when maybe it's not like your favorite way to spend time.
Yeah, it's always right at my birthday. Sometimes it's actually on my, I'd be there for my birthday. So that sucks. But yeah, I was going to, you know, this felt different. Like we could make our own little reality there. And it was really goofy. And I think, you know, a little goofiness is like, to me, that's this little spice that needs to be added. I just think in business, people just really feel like they have to be seen as being serious and legitimate. And I actually have thought a lot about how much that was important to me in coffee travel, is to legitimize myself. Cause I just always felt like I didn't have enough of that. I didn't have enough feeling that in coffee I was legitimate. And everybody else had the 1953 Probat roaster, and everyone else had this whatever espresso machine and new things. But I always wanted coffee to be easy and accessible, and to demystify it, you know, to not sort of talk in code as much as possible. And when you did have to try to explain it, you know. I think that's what I like about your podcast so much, is because I was actually really intimidated by it. And the first episodes are kind of like boot camp, and they're really good, and there's so much there. But I just realized how much you want people to get it, and you want it to be understandable. And I really respect that. You want to focus on producers and what their needs are, and I think that's really great. But I do think you give a really good access to everybody who wants to listen, who wants to, you know, understand.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I wanted to ask you what you've, as a prolific blogger and a podcaster, what made you feel like you wanted to do a podcast when you write so much, or how do you find those two different?
Well, I've been really bad at doing podcasts because I have like 30 episodes in like 8 years or something. I guess I think mostly about how hard it is for me to do it, because a lot of times I don't want to hear myself talk and I don't want to see myself. So it's kind of, it takes something to get to a point where I feel like I want to try. And I do very much this thing you do, which is I just put it out there and then try to like forget about it. And it hasn't, you know, it hasn't always worked for me. I sometimes I've tried to work really hard on something I felt needed to be said. There was a thing I did about geisha a long time ago because I'd read a lot about it. I think the problem with my approach was that I felt a little angry about the success of geisha in Panama specifically, where I felt like it was just about this little handful of group of farmers that were doing incredibly well. And there's a lot of good coffee. You know, geisha is really nice coffee sometimes, you know, quite often. So when I looked back and I saw the history of it and how it was collected, and it was part of the ICO Gardens, and it was about, you know, that program is about helping all farmers to fight disease and to find stronger varieties and to have a good genetic database and these great things that organizations do sometimes to help coffee farmers, I believe. And that's, you know, why geisha exists in the ICO collections, that it was taken from in Costa Rica and then planted in Panama. And I wrote this whole thing explaining it, and I guess it was a little snarky, and I just like, apparently was like disinvited from Boquete after that. The reaction, because wow, people did see it, was terrible. I got hate mail and like, you're not welcome here kind of emails. So it's made it really hard to say what you think. And, you know, I do want to check and make sure I'm not holding some sort of grudge and trying to work out some resentment I have. I don't want to do things. I want to do things that are helpful, but producing material is hard. So I can understand why you don't want to see comments. I don't want to see any. I don't want to be disinvited from anywhere else, I guess.
So looking back on that piece, would you just not do it again? Would you just kind of not say anything about it? Or would you say something about it in a different context? Or is it maybe just unavoidable?
I don't know. I don't think I would do that again. It really took a toll on me. It really hurt, honestly. I'm pretty sensitive about the energy you put into things is like a lot. You know, I can tell you do, and I feel that I do too. And, you know, I do want to check in with my intentions before, because as a person who felt kind of illegitimate in coffee and needing to prove something, I need to kind of note that coming from that place can make you a little weird and do things that, you know, you're not happy with. So if I'm trying to prove something, then I probably wouldn't have written that. But I think that the information was really good.
Is the piece still on your website? Does it still exist? Or did you take it down from the backlash?
It does, but yeah, I don't really want it seen. I don't know, because I don't know. Maybe, you know,
but
maybe
I think
there
that's
is
interesting.
Something.
Yeah, but you didn't take it down. I'm not encouraging anyone to go look for it. I'm just saying you made this thing, you had this painful response to it, and yet something about you decided to let it keep existing. You didn't remove it from your website.
Yeah, it's funny because I did realize I took down another video that was really controversial too, and it was a joke video I made about coffee buying. It was a joke based directly on dangerous grounds, and it got some attention too. But there was a really nice article that referenced it that was pointing out how this idea of the coffee hunter had become such a trope that you could parody it so easily. And it's a farm in like Papua New Guinea where I was there, and I'm like walking around like misidentifying trees and taking real like the hardest path to get somewhere with all the coffee whacking me in the face, and then looking at the cherry and just saying the wrong things. Fun. And I put it up, and then it got a lot of confusion, a lot of confused responses. I'll say our video on hand cupping, Dan and I made a video about how hand feel, we have mouth feel, but hand feel, talks about. So we actually were cupping from our hands so we could feel the coffee. And that got a lot of I guess we were good enough. We were this straight face enough that people were like, are they serious? Is this, you know?
Is this on YouTube?
Yeah, that one is hand cupping. But I think it says something that you can make parodies in coffee, but they're not that out there because people do things that you can't believe. So, and I think that was because there was a company in Colorado who advertised their coffee as hand scooped.
Their
coffee was special because they hand scoop.
Okay. Oh my
I'm
gosh.
I'm not joking.
As soon as I hang up with you, I want to go look up that hand cupping video because that sounds fantastic.
It might be hard to find. I can send it to you.
A lot of this regulation and the conversation around adulterated coffees and like what should be allowed and what shouldn't be allowed, I feel like there's not enough producers who are part of that conversation, and it directly impacts their economic livelihood. And I see it as like, I'm trying to think of an analogy, and the only thing I could think of is like, let's say I hate the color blue and I think it's just a really terrible color. It looks terrible on my skin. It just makes me feel really bad. I hate blue. And therefore I tell some fashion company, you can't use the color blue because I don't like it. It makes me feel bad. You are not allowed to use it and sell it to other people who think blue is perfectly fine. Like, I just feel like this type of regulation happens a lot where it's like, I don't like it. My feelings are hurt. So you're not allowed to do it. And we're going to regulate it.
Well, you're talking to the guy, we just offered spiced coffee. And I really thought about it. I was like, do I want to go this way? It was like a Indonesian aged spiced Sumatra. So it was aged with a spice blend. And it was really interesting. But there's a lot of new things coming up that aren't well determined. And I think whether people, how they sort of evaluate them in the marketplace, you know, should involve producers too. And, and also just like to let people find where that coffee should go. Like if it's not right for this marketplace, and then, but it works really well somewhere else, you know, just like winey coffee in Indonesia, or, you know, the levels of fruit that they like in Saudi Arabia. It's like, well, if they like it, okay.
And I think the other thing that comes up again is this double standard of not just machines, like we love our toys and machines on one end of the supply chain, but not on the other. And this innovation, like there's so much, especially going to SCA, you see so much innovation in terms of equipment or recipes or technology. Like there's so much innovation, but we feel very uncomfortable when producers innovate, like adding spices or whatever that could be, you know, relevant to their culture. We're like, no, not you. We get to innovate. We get to do that stuff, but not you. You need to be pure and authentic and, you know, stay in your box of what we know you. And I just think that we don't. And again, like that's a fine position to have. Like you can have that opinion, but just understanding that there is a double standard. And like, I have a lot of double standards with my husband of things I'm allowed to do, but he's not allowed to do. And so, but I'm aware of these double standards. You know, I think that's what bothers mm-hmm. me more, is not that there are double standards, but that we refuse to acknowledge them and think that there's like this equal playing field all over the place.
Yeah. That struck me when I was listening to your talk with Vava in Kenya, because mm-hmm. I think she brought, you know, can a producer look like this? Like people comment on how she looks, you know, I believe that was text, and you know, that she's, you know, impressive and fashionable and, you know, is like, and just this idea that like, is that okay?
Right. And how people want to do. Yeah. We want producers to do well, but not so well. Like there's a limit to like our generosity, and there's like a limit to what we're able to accept, where if they do have a new car, where it's like, well, why aren't you investing in your business? And why is that a new car and not a new pulper? Or something like that, where there's so much judgment on how producers are allowed to spend any extra money. And that same criticism is not kind of focused the other way of like, you know, what are you wearing? Or how many vacations do you get to go on per year?
Cultural prejudices exist. And I don't think they're, you know, sometimes they're just crusty old things that maybe, you know, for me, sometimes you're just not used to, you know, and the first time you see them, I don't think it's to disallow them, but it's to say like, oh, that kind of changes how I feel. But I run up against my own preconceptions. And I know that's because when we think of our coffee and what the classic ideas of really good, clean, washed coffee, and we think about the situations that comes from, where people do what they did, their parents did, and what their parents did, and the traditions handed down in coffee, you know, we're very conservative. You know, we have this very conservative bias, I think, that we come to it with. I think, you know, maybe at least people like myself, we like that and we want it to continue. I'm sad to hear when people start single fermenting in Burundi and they stop double fermenting. But I challenge that. I have no reason to believe that. I don't know precisely. It pleases my mind to know that they do this old system that was set up. You know, honestly, it was set up in colonial times. And it's from a British system that was imposed upon people. They were forced to do this way. And to innovate, to say, well, why are we doing this? Is this necessary? Can you tell the difference? You know, and challenge that. I think, you know, I feel these two things. One is this very conservative love of washed coffee as it's been and the way it's produced. And the other is like just a reasonable response to that. It's like, is this really necessary? Would this be better? Oh, well, hell yeah, they should do it if it's better, if they can ferment one time or do something else that improves the way they're working.
Or another like component there would be the wash process creates an incredible amount of wastewater and a lot of pollution. And so by being able to reduce or eliminate one of those washing steps, you create less pollution. So your emissions are lower. And so even if it's not better for quality, even if it's not like shedding an old colonial system, it could be part of the mission of reducing your carbon emissions and being more, you know, I don't know about environmentally friendly, but less environmentally polluting.
Mm-hmm. No, Panagos has done amazing. The use of eco-pulpers has done amazing things in coffee that I realize isn't to everyone's, you know, it doesn't please them. And, you know, I struggled with it too, but, you know, in the cases of Costa Rica, where people create small mills in locations that weren't the, you know, the old landowners had all the properties by the rivers and could use all the water they needed for these giant mills. And they, yep. they, you know, produce, you know, a coffee farmer couldn't process their own coffee. Panagos allowed that to happen, where they could just transport, you know, one, you know, container of water up the hill and run the whole mill the whole day. And in Ethiopia, I mean, it changed a lot in the West, the Western part, where co-ops could start processing their own coffee despite their location. And then, you know, of course, not return that coffee to that water to the rivers and manage it, you know, very environmentally, in a very environmentally sound way. So I think, well, some people really don't like the Panagos, and I like seeing washed coffee where it traditionally fermented. You got to respect that, what that has done and how
exactly.
that's helped people.
No, I think that's a really good point, in that this piece of equipment opened up that opportunity for a lot of producers who were previously forced to sell their cherry for a low price. And then if they could process it and sell, you know, wet parchment, or if they could dry it and sell dry parchment, they could make a lot more money than just selling their cherry. And so that's what I'm talking about, where a lot of people, because when you use this eco-pulper, you eliminate that fermentation step. You don't always get that opportunity to enhance the flavor through this processing step, that the coffees can be maybe not as vibrant as they could be if they underwent a long fermentation. So that's where someone's like, well, I don't like those coffees. I don't like that flavor. That's like boring or flat. But it allowed, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people to like now process something that they couldn't before. And so I'm like, your preference is really not important. It's like, but we present it as like, but my preference is the most important thing, and cup quality and flavor and scores is the most important thing. And I just think we're really, really unbalanced in that way. Where I'm like, your opinion is nothing compared to now these people can make more money, and now their kids can go to school, and maybe they can escape coffee, and they don't have to keep growing coffee. They can do something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, coffee isn't the answer for everyone. And I think a lot of coffee projects that have gone on, it's like, I always wonder, is maybe one of the options that you present to people is not farming coffee.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the best thing if you're really thinking of the lives and, you know, life improvement. So.
Absolutely. And I wanted to have this conversation hasn't come out on the podcast yet, but I think by the time this episode comes out, I will have shared this conversation with Mark from Finca Rosenheim in Peru. So he was on episode 27, and I just got a chance to catch up with him. And he mentioned two things about tourism. And well, sorry, one thing about tourism is that he had some people, I think he said from Switzerland, come visit him, two young guys who just wanted to learn more about coffee. So it could have turned out to be a potentially very extractive model of, they're just like, they're not even buyers. They just want to come visit the farm and learn about coffee. But they stayed long enough. I think they stayed for almost a month, and they really helped out. He had a building project, and they learned about coffee, but they provided their labor. He said he was thrilled to have them. They worked for like a month. They were moving wood. They were helping him, I don't know, with his trucks. Like, they were really contributing. And I think that's...
Wow.
I was really impressed. I'm like, that's a really cool model. So I think, you know, maybe somebody who is thinking about a trip to say, how can I help? How can I contribute? And sometimes it's like more effort to teach somebody something they don't know. And like, okay, you're going to get hurt. I don't want you to touch those things or that equipment. But to see if there is something that, you know, as you're visiting somebody, what you can give back. And the other thing I wanted to point out with Mark is that in that episode, in episode 27, he was really in a difficult place with the prices, and he really felt like he needed to escape coffee. And a lot of the conversation revolved around, you know, what else could he grow? What else could he do? Diversifying and reducing his, like, we talked about having an exit strategy for coffee. Because, like you said, you can't just pick up your land and go somewhere else. It takes a long time to replant. So there's limited options. So when I asked him, in 2023, how he was compared to 2020, he does have less coffee because he's planted more lumber and he's reforesting. But that was the better choice for him, was to have less coffee, to plant less coffee, to concentrate on less and to do other things. And so I think a lot, oftentimes that could seem as like a failure. We always want to have like more coffee and plant more, but maybe a way for success for some producers is to think about other options.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, here, coffee is one of the things, it's the cash crop they grow along with all their sustenance crops. And if you don't really look at the whole picture and you just talk to people about coffee, it's really missing the whole point of what balance works. And for a lot of farmers here, they have too few trees. The amount of resources they have to devote to too few trees doesn't produce enough coffee to make it very worth it. But, you know, they kind of continue to do that. So that's one other recommendation, kind of going the opposite direction, is either have more coffee or don't have any coffee, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I like the idea of exit. I always want to do this thing from the other side of the mirror. I wanted to always talk to roasters who quit roasting and baristas who quit baristering. And
yeah,
you could ask farmers who quit coffee and like find out, because you never hear from them. Like, you know, because a lot of times I have really candid views. I talked to a barista recently when I was surfing, and she had quit, and she just had really funny and insightful comments about the coffee world as she saw it, you know, having left it. So maybe that'd be a great episode, is talking to the exes and, you know, looking back over their shoulder. What do they think? I would love to know farms that left coffee, or, you know, how they saw it, if they downscaled.
I love that idea. So, okay, this is an official call out for, if you are somebody who has left coffee or know somebody who has left coffee, we want to hear from you. So email us.
Yeah.
I'll have all the links in the show notes.
We want to hear from all the quitters.
Yeah. I mean, cause that's a perspective I have in my job as a consultant. It's like, for me, success is becoming irrelevant. For me is like, I was able to share what I wanted to share, and now you don't need me anymore, or you've graduated beyond me. Like, I'm always trying to like get myself out of the way. And so this idea of, yeah, they're making yourself relevant or quitting or escaping is very interesting to me. Thanks to you for listening to this conversation. I hope it brought up some interesting topics for you to think about. Do you see your own travel in a different way? What about the role of host and guest? Are there some things that you have taken for granted as you visit coffee-producing countries? Also, are you a former barista, roaster, or coffee producer? Tom and I really do want to hear from the quitters. Please send us an email at info.luciacoffee@gmail.com telling us about it. Remember to check out the Sweet Maria's podcast for more thoughtful reflections and coffee travel stories from Tom, as well as home roasting. Another huge thanks to the patrons who make it possible for me to make new episodes. If you want to join our community and join the Office Hours Live to ask me questions or connect with other awesome listeners, go to patreon.com/makingcoffee. So all of this will be linked in the show notes. And if you see coffee in a different way after listening, consider joining on Patreon and helping me make more episodes. If you enjoy listening and get value out of these episodes, please share with a friend who loves wine or coffee. If you want to be notified when the next one is coming out, consider subscribing to my free and infrequent newsletter at luxia.coffee. Luxia is L-U-X-I-A. Thanks for listening, and remember, life's too short to drink bad coffee.